Somehow, I think black holes are one of the most fascinating solutions or sets of exact solutions in general relativity. And I think one of the reasons that we like to explore them is that they give us a handle, or they give us an example of an object in gravity, which not only is singular, it leads to a breakdown of the equations of general relativity, but also potentially can give us a region, a means of exploring strong gravity, yet in a region with low relative gravitational curvature. So for the black hole at the center of our galaxy, for example, which is about a million solar masses, the local curvature at the event horizon is quite gentle. So it would be quite possible for somebody to go and explore the event horizon of the black hole, just not possible for them to come back and tell us about it afterwards. So it's not like black holes are these very extreme places in nature, at least not necessarily. So we do have examples of black holes in cosmology or in astrophysics which do not have sort of extreme phenomena right near the event horizon. So it's a means of exploring, of pushing against general relativity as a classical theory. So that's one sort of motivator about why to think about black holes in higher dimensions. But then, of course, the other motivator is that from the context of string theory, where we believe that we do, in fact, have many extra dimensions, there are generalizations of black hole solutions, which are black brains, which I'll sort of at least give you some examples of towards the end of the lecture. And these black brains are believed to actually correspond to fundamental objects within string theory. And so this correspondence between some classical gravitational solution and some fundamentally quantum object in string theory, that's what leads to the ADS-CFT correspondence. So the notion that there are two different ways of describing the same thing. So that's sort of two reasons to explore black holes in higher dimensions. So I want to start by looking at black holes in Kaluza-Klein theory. So we saw what Kaluza-Klein theory was yesterday, and I introduced it in the simplest possible case. So the basic solutions of Kaluza-Klein theory are just vacuum five-dimensional gravitational solutions. Sorry, David, have they got a handout or something? Or is that...
For Kaluza-Klein.
Oh, that's the homework, because I was just thinking with the hand. I thought, oh, if there's a handout, let me see what they're looking at.
There's a handout as well, but it's about what you did yesterday.
Okay, yeah. Right. So there's nothing about black holes on it. Okay. So since I said with Kaluza-Klein theory that we essentially the extra dimension was small and everything was averaged over it, we also expect a killing vector of d by d psi. So these are the types of vacuum solutions that we're going to look for. And in fact, it doesn't take us too long to write down the first one and the very basic one. When we calculated the curvature of what we called the warp metric, we had this extra direction being dz squared, and then we had an overall warp factor or function of z multiplying a four-dimensional space. And it turned out that our Ricci curvature was had things involving derivatives of the warp factor and also the Ricci curvature of the four-dimensional space. Now, what I've written down here is the Schwarzschild solution in four dimensions, which is Ricci flat. And if you like, this is a warp metric with a constant warp factor of 1. So I immediately see that this solution is Ricci flat, but it looks like the Schwarzschild simply extended along the psi direction. So this is what we call a black string. And so it's Schwarzschild cross R, or an interval of R, and it kind of just, the event horizon looks something like that. That's our black string. So that's a very simple example of a Kaluza-Klein black hole. So when we reduce down to four dimensions, there's no cross terms. So this is uncharged. Remember, our five-dimensional gravity went to four-dimensional scalar tensor gravity with a sort of pseudo-electromagnetism. So this is an uncharged Schwarzschild black hole. So this looks like Schwarzschild black hole from a four-dimensional perspective. So what can we do more generally? Well, the first thing we can think about is introducing cross terms. And when we think about how we might do that, we could imagine boosting that black string. So we could imagine doing a Lorentz transformation on the black string. Now, normally you might think, oh, that looks translationally invariant. That's just a Lorentz transformation, is just a change of coordinates. It shouldn't actually do anything. But that's not quite true. And the reason it's not true is because once you've periodically identified your fifth direction, the psi direction, you've fixed a rest frame. Let's just see what that means. Here's my T psi plane. A Lorentz transformation simply shifts the coordinates. It just changes what you mean by time and psi. But you can see that periodic identification means that you identify psi with psi plus L at constant time. So it's not just two points being identified. You're identifying psi with psi plus L at constant T, X, Y, Z, or whatever your other coordinates are. So the moment you do a Lorentz transformation, that means you have to start identifying coordinates, not just at different psi prime, but also at different t prime. So that's the identification that you have to do. saying is just that if you do a boost on the black string before identifying, that's distinct from identifying the psi direction and then boosting. So if I move or boost in this direction, then I'm going to generate a sort of charge from my black hole, because by making one of these boosts, you can see that you're mixing the T and psi directions. So you're going to generate a GT psi, which is the same as an AT. So that's what we mean by charge. So let's actually see that explicitly. So all I've done here is I've written down that same black string solution, but I've done a Lorentz transformation on the T psi coordinates. So if you look at what happens to the cross terms, you can see that here you've got a sort of 2v on 1 minus v squared, whereas here you've got a 2v on 1 minus v squared multiplied by 1 minus r plus on r. So they're not the same. So they're not going to cancel. So that's telling you normally you'd expect a Lorentz transformation to preserve the form of the, you know, form of the metric. But that's not so here, because you've got this Newtonian potential sitting out in front of the time component. And so doing this Lorentz boost before identifying is giving you a distinct solution. So what you want to do So we need to reorganize this top line into the Kaluza-Klein format, which means identifying the psi-psi component. So that was our scalar field, the size of the internal dimension. And you can see that's just a 1 over 1 minus v squared minus this potential factor, 1 minus r plus on r times v. V squared on 1 minus V squared. So that groups together to give you this prefactor. Then you complete the square by making sure that the cross terms add up. And then you have to just correct or see what you're left with for GTT. So that's what the having grouped together all the pieces, this is what our metric looks like in the original coordinates. So seeing that, it's kind of obvious that you want to redefine your radial coordinate just to make things look a little bit nicer. And then this is the gauge field, the Kaluza-Klein gauge field. So that's also proportional to 1 over this redefine coordinate. So the first thing I'll do is shift the origin of my radial coordinate. Then I'll identify a charge. So that this thing looks like Q1R. So now I've got a very familiar looking potential for my A0. So that's what you would expect of an electric charge. And then my scalar field again, everything has this common structure of, or sort of your scalar field has this structure of 1 minus constant over r, or r hat in this case, although in this case it's 1 over that. So you can see this this sort of three-dimensional Laplace potential of 1 over r coming in all of these situations. You've got a 1 over r in the Kaluza-Klein gauge field. You've got a sort of 1 over r in the scalar field. And then I'll write it in terms of the tilde, the Einstein frame metric. Okay, so I've just re-expressed that five-dimensional metric in terms of what we called our G tilde, our four-dimensional Einstein frame metric, which is that ds tilde squared, a gauge potential A, and the scalar field of the scalar tensor part. So you can see that this is beginning to look rather different from the familiar Rice and Nordstrom style of black hole. So here you see now that you've not got an area gauge. So you have also two potentials. You've got something which you would think of as being coming from the black hole charge or a mass, and something which comes from the actual Kaluza-Klein electromagnetic charge, the A field. But you also notice that you've suddenly got square roots, or at least not integer powers of these potentials. And you can see that there's two places where GTT goes to zero. So just like Reisner and Nordstrom, you can ask what the extremal limit is of this solution. And so the extremal limit, at this point, what we've done is we've just boosted the black string with some parameter V, the boost parameter V. To get the extremal limit, you can sort of see that you want VQ to go to R plus hat. And what that actually means is you boost the black string to the speed of light, and at the same time, you send the original R plus to zero while keeping the ratio R plus over 1 minus V squared constant. So you tend to see this a bit, at least with solutions of general relativity. You can sort of get something non-trivial. It's like boosting a zero-mass solution. It's like a zero-mass black string solution boosted to the speed of light, and it ends up not being zero-mass because you've taken the limit in a sneaky way. That's what you do. You put the you take the limit of that solution over there. But what you find when you do that is that what you end up with is a singular solution. So the what was the event horizon at R plus becomes a null singularity. So that's what you end up with.
To be taken to 0 or to 1?
Oh. V goes to 1, thanks. Speed of light is not 0. That's not 1 really, but... So that's what an electric black hole looks like. There's also another pure gravitational solution in 5D that has the interpretation of a charged black hole in 4D, and that's a magnetically charged black hole. Now let me just check. When you did Reisner and Nordström in the tutorial, did you look at magnetic charges? No? Okay. So one of the curious things, at least in four dimensions, is that as well as having an electrically charged black hole, you can get a magnetically charged black hole. So that means that your F because I want to sort of extend this to Kaluza-Klein theory. So in this case, your if you think about this, this is a Maxwell field strength that's purely spatial. It's d theta cross d phi. So if you want to think about what that would be in the sort of in the sense of the old E and B fields, so your B field is just the three-dimensional dual of the stress tensor. And so if there's a theta and phi component, that tells you that you've got a radial magnetic field here. So this solution, if you just write down this gauge field, you can see that obviously DF is zero. But also, if you look at the delta, the D of the dual of F, that's also zero. And so this is a solution, notionally, to the Maxwell equations. But of course, if you didn't have gravity, you would have trouble going down to R equals zero. So without gravity, you have some sort of point singularity. If you add in gravity, however, you can cloak that with the event horizon of a black hole. And then when you look at the energy momentum tensor of this, it has the same energy momentum tensor. Now I'm talking about Reisner and Nordström here, not Kaluza-Klein theory, as the electrically charged black hole. So it's the same stress tensor, which means the same geometry. So your Reisner and Nordström black hole has the same form whether you have F or you have the dual of F as your source. So you have this relation, this duality between electric and magnetic solutions.
Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of confused where we're using the fact that psi is periodic. Because we said that if psi is not periodic, then it should reduce to Schwarzschild. But I don't see where we used it in this derivation.
You mean of the electrically charged black hole?
Yeah.
Well, so with the electrically charged black hole, it's saying in by fixing... if you didn't fix the periodicity of psi, you could imagine actually just, so it's a moving string, but you would say, but actually that's just the same as if I was running along beside the string. It's the same physical solution. It's just that I'm running past the string at the same time. So you wouldn't be able to distinguish the two solutions. Once you've identified, though, you're saying that you're identifying psi with psi plus L at t equals constant, you then can't sort of unravel the effect of that boost. So there is a distinction between you sort of, I mean, I know we smear over this extra dimension, so we couldn't physically run along, you know, in it, but it's that sort of notion that without the identification, all you've done is taken the same physical object and done a coordinate transformation. So although it looks different mathematically, it's physically the same. But once you do the identification, so I'm kind of referring back to that picture on the top board, once you do the identification, you've now got physically distinct objects, because if you wanted to relate this second black hole, which is, as I've written it down, I'm identifying psi at constant t there. That's distinct from if I were to ask, well, what happens with t prime and psi prime, which would be the black string, something that was kind of co-moving with the black string. So they're not the same physically. They are actually distinct. So for Kaluza-Klein theory, I want to produce the same F, which means I need to construct a gauge potential. So the obvious thing to do would be to just say, well, this is d of minus cos theta d phi. So that's why I get that minus cos theta in the gauge potential. But this is part of a metric. In a metric, I have to worry about singularities. I have to make sure that they're just coordinate singularities and not real ones. So normally, we don't worry about the polar singularities at theta equals naught and pi because we know how to get rid of them. We just use, you know, x is r sine theta cos phi, et cetera, et cetera. But in this case, I'm looking at something where I've got a g psi phi, and I have to make sure this A is regular at north and south poles. So for this, that's why I've added in this plus or minus one. So what I've really got here are two distinct gauge fields, one which works at the North Pole and one which works at the South Pole. So I have to figure out, you know, this automatically tells me I've got to have two separate patches for a North Pole and a South Pole patch. So if I'll just write down this is what my 5D metric looks like. And that is regular at the North Pole. So you can see that this is the charge of the solution. So the way I've constructed it, that's fine, except that I can't include the South Pole in my coordinate patch. So instead, I need this South Pole patch, and so you see that what I've really done is a coordinate transformation . So I need to shift. If I shift my psi angle between the north and south patches by 2q phi, then that takes account of that 1 going to a minus 1. So it's nothing sort of too drastic. All I've got to do is just change what I mean by the psi angle between the north part of my solution and the south part of my solution. And then everything's okay. So this is an example of one of these coordinate transition functions that we have. We've got two coordinate charts, something that sort of covers everything but the South Pole and something that covers everything but the North Pole. On the overlap, I've got a transition function telling me how to get from one set of coordinates to the other. Only one coordinate changes. But in both cases, my psi has to have the same periodicity. So my psi is identified with psi plus L. So that tells me that 4 pi q has to be some integer times L. So it's not difficult to deal with this patching, so these different coordinate systems, North and South Pole, but there is a price to be paid. And the price is this solution only makes sense if the charge of the monopole is quantized. Or you could turn it around and say, given a magnetic monopole with charge Q, L can only take specific values, which, if you look, as you will see in your homework, that is related to electric charge of fields. So that's saying that the existence of a single magnetic monopole means electric charge is quantized. Now, we've looked at this from the context of geometry and looking at Kaluza-Klein fields, but we could kind of forget about solutions to the Einstein equations and just ask about, well, what happens if I have a magnetic monopole, just in normal Maxwell theory? And you'll find the same sort of things happening. You have to do, in this case, just a gauge patching, a patching of your gauge fields between the north and south. And then you find that for regularity of particle wave functions, you also have to have the same sort of quantization condition. So this was when Dirac originally put forward a magnetic monopole in about, I guess, I don't know if it was 33 or 35, he'd been playing around with these magnetic fields and looking at what happened if you had a gauge potential that was appropriate to a magnetic field. And he found that, well, there was always a singularity somewhere, so that got called the Dirac string. And the only way that it made sense if you were looking at wave functions propagating through that background was if that singularity was not observable, which meant you had to have a particular condition, a quantization condition. So it's one of those sort of little peculiarities that, you know, at the time you sort of thought, oh, this could be really important. The existence of a single magnetic monopole anywhere in the universe implies quantization of electric charge. So let's just look in a little bit more at this magnetic monopole, because it's got actually some other rather nice properties. Our extremal limit, so again, in the case of Riesner and Nordström, the extremal limit was where the two event horizons coincided. And you can see here you've got something that happens when R goes to R plus, something that happens when R goes to R minus. So in this case, however, if you set R plus to R minus, this prefactor completely goes away. So there's no potential in front of the time component of the metric. And the factors in front of this sort of two-sphere distance element and the extra dimension also start having this same R minus R plus factor. So I'm going to set Q. Going to look at just the single n equals 1 charged monopole, and I'm going to redefine my extra dimension, the coordinate chi, such that my extra angle has periodicity 4 pi. So it looks like I've got a singularity as R goes to R plus, but I'm going to do the same trick that I did with Euclidean Schwarzschild. And in fact, it's not that silly a thing to do, because this is really just some time direction times a Euclidean Ricci flat manifold, but nonetheless it's non-trivial because it's got these potentials, 1 minus R plus on R. So I'm going to take a new radial coordinate, which is proportional to the square root of R minus R plus. So my aim here is to turn that into d rho squared. So then if I look what happens as R tends to R plus here, this prefactor is looking like a rho squared, and it's actually looking like a sort of rho squared on 4. Here I've got R plus squared, so I've got common factor. between those two pieces. And this whole thing here is actually just the distance element on a unit three sphere expressed in Euler angles as opposed to the sort of iterative the way you go hop up from an S2 to an SN by simply repeating, you know, d theta squared plus sine squared theta, d phi squared plus sine squared theta, sine squared phi, d chi squared, et cetera, et cetera. So what that is in the brackets there is just the origin, or near the origin, this d rho squared plus rho squared on 4. Well, I suppose the quarter should be included in the d omega 3 squared there. It's just Euler angles. It's just a different way of coordinatizing the three sphere. So so this monopole is topologically R5, so it's completely smooth. And yet, as you move out to r equals infinity, you see that the theta phi directions grow. So they look like r squared, d omega 2 squared at large r. So you have two of the directions of the three sphere actually blowing up, whereas the chi direction remains fixed. So it really is a Kaluza-Klein solution at large R. You've got a single little circle which is sitting, you know, with a sort of large two-sphere, but you always have, you've always got to do this patching between north and south pole. And this is known as a hop vibration. And so it's really saying you can represent the three sphere. You can sort of take the northern hemisphere, kind of put sort of sew on these little chain mails. You can imagine adding in your psi direction as just stitching chain mail on top of your two sphere. But to get the right structure, when you identify at the equator, you identify with a twist that kind of increases as you go round and eventually becomes 2 pi as you've come back to yourself. And so that just that non-trivial identification around the equator sort of means that you have your topologically you're going from S2 to S3, not S2 cross S1. So it is a Kaluza-Klein compactification, but because you've got this non-trivial twist, which is hidden away in that gauge transformation, you sort of lift your topology up nicely. So this was discovered by Raphael Sorkin and David Gross and Malcolm Perry. And I sort of recommend, if you're interested in this, to look at their original papers, because they're sort of clearly written. So the Kaluza-Klein monopole is kind of one of these curious compactifications. It's something that's completely non-singular and yet has this non-trivial interpretation. So that's our pure Kaluza-Klein solutions. So what you've noticed is that by, although the monopole itself, you can think of it as being, it's although it looks like it's got, it certainly has this d by d psi Killing vector. And so you could imagine it as being a sort of little loop. In fact, it is point-like from the perspective of five dimensions as well as four dimensions, whereas the electrically charged solution is definitely more string-like in that it sort of has some sort of extent in that fifth dimension. And of course, the black string itself clearly is a cylinder rather than some sort of point-like object in higher dimensions. So what we've seen is that adding in extra dimensions means that you don't just get black holes, you get black strings, black membranes, and these we just generically call black brains. So let me just say a few words about, about different solutions that you can have more generally. So an example of a higher dimensional black hole you can certainly extend the Schwarzschild solution to higher dimensions. So this is a genuine black hole in higher dimensions. And all that you see is that the potential just changes. Instead of 1 over r, it's 1 over r to the d minus 3 in arbitrary dimension d. Sorry, that should be d minus 2 there. And so these have a mass. So to get the mass of a solution, you look at large R and you look at the fall-off of essentially the spatial part of the metric. So you can see that you've got an R plus to the D minus 3 coming in there. And then the other factors are just the correct normalization. So that's a black hole. You can always get black string solutions or black brain solutions. By taking one of these black hole solutions and simply adding flat directions. So I argued that that's how you construct the black string, because we saw that the higher dimensional Ricci curvature, if you just added flat directions, was simply sort of related to the lower dimensional Ricci curvature. So if that's zero, this also has zero Ricci curvature. But of course, it's more interesting to think about what charges these brains can actually carry. in order to charge up an extended object, you can't necessarily do that with just a sort of normal U1 type gauge field, sort of an A mu. So you need to have these general form fields. So to just for the sake of economy, I'm just writing down a sort of generic action of a low energy supergravity coming from string theory. And here the sort of first line is fairly generic. So this would be present in all supergravities. And then this part is additional form. So this would be something that would really be coming from type 2. Supergravity, where you get all these different dimensionality gauge potentials. So the P here means AP is a P-form gauge potential.
What's H squared ABC?
So H is, sorry, this is the standard, H is the field strength of a two-form gauge potential. So it's so this is the Nerva-Schwartz two-form potential. So that kind of, when you come to do string theory, you'll see that the string itself has a sort of this B field on its world sheet, and so that's kind of the space-time equivalent of it. So that's a sort of common ingredient. So you can see that typically, when you look at this gravity in 10 dimensions, you have all these different fields floating around. And so potentially, you have the possibility of looking at objects which are charged under those fields. So the solutions have a general form. Everything just depends on this radial coordinate. So this is a flat P, R to the P space. And so the idea is that this represents your P brain. This is the transverse space. And so this is like dr squared plus r squared d omega 2 squared for the Schwarzschild solution. So these spheres surround your brain in this d minus p minus 1 dimensional space. And parallel to the brain, in general, you've got sort of slightly different potentials in front of the T and the XP direction. So if I were to look at the black string would have, be in slightly different coordinates, but this would be like Schwarzschild, the R theta phi direction of Schwarzschild. I'd have my standard 1 minus 2gm on R in front of my dt squared, and I'd also have just 1 here, where this X would be psi. So you can see how this kind of builds up, and whether, so A and B tend to have two contributions, one coming from like the mass of the brain and the other coming from the charge. And so you sort of see how you build up these particular solutions. And then typically, from a space-time point of view, extremal solutions have A equals B. And so what you end up with is a single common potential multiplying your brain directions and then your transverse space. So that's the general structure of a black brain solution. And I'd just like to sort of write down just a couple of examples so that you see how the solutions get charged under the different fields that are floating around. So as an example, I want to sort of show examples of both electric and magnetically charged solutions. So this example here, which is of a five brain, why is it a five brain? Well, if you kind of look at the the degrees of freedom here, we've got our transverse space. And here's our time coordinate with a potential. And here are the parallel five directions, which have no factor in front of them at all. So this is this epsilon 3 is like d theta cross d phi cross d psi or whatever. It's the unit sort of volume form on the omega 3. And so here, notice this has got some similarities with the Kaluza-Klein monopole in that here is your five-dimensional now Newtonian potential. You've got an R plus and an R minus, one on the top, one on the bottom. And you can see that if R minus goes to R plus, then this factor, again, just becomes one. So this also has a dilaton field, that scalar there. Put that down for completeness. And so as R minus tends to R plus, it actually becomes non-singular, which is kind of, again, similar to the Kaluza-Klein monopole. So how do you see that? It's just gone to one, so there you go. That doesn't have anything in front of it to worry about. All you've got to worry about is this thing in here. So if this factor becomes the same, if these two factors become the same, then what you've got is dr over 1 minus r plus squared on r squared. And so what you can do is you redefine your radial coordinate, and you see that the proper distance as r tends to r plus is actually infinite. So you could rewrite this as dt squared minus d rho squared minus an r squared of rho, d omega 3 squared, And so where this is completely regular, but this, as rho tends to minus infinity, so this is rho is throughout the whole of the real line, this r just tends to r plus. So it's a completely regular solution. So it's kind of quite analogous to our Kaluza-Klein monopole, but of course it's a genuinely charged solution because it's not vacuum. It's got this gauge field here. We also get a string. Which is electrically charged. So this is just another solution of the equations of motion derived from that action, where you can, when I say it's electrically charged, you've got a B Tx of y. So that's just like saying it's At of y. So y here is obviously just a rescaled radial coordinate. And you get this r minus is something that's related to the charge. So you've got the q being related to r minus. Delta is like your black hole, the existence of a black hole. And so here, if you take the extremal limit, which is delta goes to zero, you get a singular solution. So again, it's quite analogous to the Kaluza-Klein situation. But this electrically charged singular solution is often identified with a sort of space-time solution corresponding to the fundamental string, because the fundamental string is charged under this B field. And then I just want to wrap up by writing down a particularly relevant solution from a string theory perspective, and that is the D3 brain. This is charged under a self-dual phi form. So this is a solution in 2B. So this is a general solution which has a sort of part of a black hole component, but then if r minus tends to r plus, that is the extremal limit. That really is the D3 brain. So the D3 brain is the extremal limit. And then your R plus is given in terms of the fundamental sort of stringy type parameters. Depends on how many sort of fundamental charge times how many of these things are piled on top of each other. But if you look at what happens as R goes to R plus, you've obviously got a sort of S5 here along for the ride. So that's kind of just got some constant size. But you'll see that this part of the metric starts to look like anti-de Sitter, five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. And so that's the sort of standard example where you have these space-time solutions which have an interpretation in terms of, you know, they're charged under the relevant gauge form fields, and they also, so they seem to correspond, or they have all the properties and all the right charges that correspond to fundamental objects in string theory. So these D-brains in string theory are endpoints for open strings. So you, I know the string theory course is coming, but I'm just sort of looking forward to that, saying that, you know, you get not just, you don't just have fundamental strings in string theory. There's also objects that strings can end on. And that's one of these objects, but looked at from a very classical, non-stringy point of view.